Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime.
Hey, you made it here safe.
I did. There were like a few patches of ice where the bridge was kind of like blocking the sun from the road.
Oh, okay.
But yeah.
So you went over the bridge?
No. Oh. No. I went the back roads.
Okay.
To get here. Just that bridge right there.
Uh-huh. Right.
The sun was shining this way, and so it was blocking
the shade. Yeah.
And all right there was like a huge patch of ice. So, but yeah, I'm glad I made it here. It snowed last night, guys, in Texas.
I know. And I was like, nothing's going to happen. The forecast kept changing. And I'm like, we're going to wake up. There's not going to be snow. But there was.
There was snow. We saw it last night when it started.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Daniel, of course, was tracking it. You know, he's been on his phone. Now it's saying 0.4, you know, inches. Yeah. Now it's saying it's going to be Sunday. Now it's saying we're not getting snow. Now it's saying we are. He's been obsessed.
It was so back and forth. I was just like, really, I'm going to go to sleep.
They kept changing it. And anyway, so about 10 o'clock last night, it started snowing.
Yeah.
Where we were anyways.
Yeah. No, yeah. I fell asleep about 10 o'clock, so I couldn't tell you.
Well, aren't you a good little girl?
Well, I was tired from doing nothing all day. No, I went to church, went out to eat with some church peeps, and came home and did nothing. Oh, I watched the terrible Cowboy game. I'm not going to talk about that.
Yikes.
Did Daniel watch it?
There were profanities.
Oh, no.
There were slamming of doors and throwing of things.
Yeah. It was not a fun night for the Cowboys.
Yeah, I do not watch sports, but I can see the devastation after the wreckage, the debris.
Yeah. Fueled. Well, and then you get on social media and you can't miss it. So, because people want to trash talk. But no, it was, that was a sad day. But yeah, so I was tired from doing just that.
Yeah. Well, I was tired because I took a muscle relaxer.
Oh.
Like one I've never taken before. My, you know, when I had my neck injury.
Okay. Yeah.
Last week.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's back. I'm not kidding.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not kidding. It's back in the same exact place. So maybe there's something wrong with me, but I took one that was like both my parents brought over several bottles of stuff. Should I be saying this one? I don't know. But my dad had been prescribed muscle relaxers for something. He never took them. So I took one of those. It was this tiny little white pill.
Yeah. So
I thought, this is going to do nothing. I took it in the morning, probably 9 a.m.
Uh-huh.
I fell asleep on the couch and woke up at like 11:30. And I was in and out of consciousness a little bit.
Yeah.
Like the girls were playing in there. Daniel was in there. Like everybody's watching TV. They were screaming and jumping around. And I was in and out.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't believe. I was like, whoa. I was like, that thing knocked me out. And then when the twins went down to sleep, I took another 2.5 hour nap.
Wow.
I was like, I'm going to wake up with the most beautiful skin, like just
well
rested.
It was just that kind of sleep.
It was just so much sleep. I thought, I'm going to wake up a whole new person. I look the same, sadly, but
so much sleep. You wonder how people can get addicted to that kind of thing.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because another thing that I really didn't like about it was I just felt detached.
Okay.
Like I just felt like,
just there.
Just there. I wasn't really, I was just like, had no energy. I just wanted to sleep.
Oh my goodness.
And I thought, my Lord, no wonder people take these things all the time.
Yeah. Right.
Goodness gracious.
I can attest that your skin is glowing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe it's chapped and not glowing. Maybe what you're seeing is more of like a chapped effect.
Maybe it's just the lighting.
Oh my gosh. We took the girls out to play in the snow earlier and they came in with just red faces, but it was fun. We were only out there for maybe 20 minutes. But how was your day? You had to work today.
I did
on MLK
work.
Day?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I'm calling out your company. That's yeah. Right.
Yeah, I don't know what's up with that, but it was we have a ton of work to do. Yeah. So it went by fast because I was busy. Yeah. So
Lane is in the medical field. So, you know, everything has to wait till Monday. So generally you are pretty stoned on a Monday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to jump into this because I do have a lot of notes about this case.
Okay.
Tonight's case is a mess. There's going to be a lot of names. A okay. lot of names. There will be a lot of names.
A lot.
I can't talk. This is going well already.
I need my notepad.
I literally say if you need to take notes. But this guy was married a bunch of times. So there's okay. a lot of wives to be like, oh, okay, wait a minute. Who okay. was this? I'll do my best to remind you as we are talking about these different women, but... yeah, for this episode, I heavily relied on a book, which I'll link in the show notes. And I used a bunch of court documents that I was able to scrounge up for this. Okay. So our story begins with an adoption.
Oh
yeah. So it starts out great.
Yeah. Sweet.
Yeah. I'm just going to bring it down from there though. A sweet little couple named Glenn and Martha Catlin adopted a baby named Stephen David Catlin in 1944. They were living in Kern County, California at the time. The couple were so pleased to have a child. I mean, most people who adopt are really want a child.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really seeking a child. And they treated him like he was their flesh and blood. It was not an adopted child for them. He was a part of their family and he was theirs. Mm. So they took care of him in the way that most parents take care of their children. Mm-hmm. Loving home. They do their best to provide. And by all accounts, Martha was a loving and doting mother. But as a young boy, they started seeing signs in Stephen that he was not like most kids.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he was a bit withdrawn and just different, you know? And not really in a good way.
Oh, you no. know,
some parents are like, oh, they're different. But
yeah,
it just wasn't a lot of the social norms he was not abiding by. So they tried to encourage him maybe more extracurricular activities and expose him to more social settings, maybe more play dates or things of that nature to hopefully draw him out a bit. Several years later, the family moved to Bakersfield, California. Well, things didn't go so well there either. It wasn't the place that was the problem. It was Stephen that was the problem.
Oh, no.
He was now in high school, and he became more and more resistant to rules and displayed complete defiance for most social norms, as I said earlier. And his parents just didn't know what to do at this point.
Right.
No punishment was working for him. No reward or, you know, anything like that. Any kind of system that, you know, us parents have in our back pocket. It just wasn't working.
Oh,
he didn't
no.
care. He was skipping school and eventually he just dropped out and stopped going altogether.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, but it wasn't like he was like, oh, I just want to be an adult. I want to get out there, get a job, and just be independent. No, 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 no. He didn't want to work.
Yeah, no.
He didn't want to work. He didn't want to do anything.
This was his world, and we're just all in it and in his way.
Yeah, he didn't want to do anything but skirt through.
Yeah.
In 1963, at just 19 years old, he was arrested for forging checks. He ended up serving 9 months at a California Youth Authority camp. I'm not really sure what that is, but he was there for almost a year. And when he got out, he found himself a chickie.
Okay.
So he got married shortly after his release from the camp. And while I don't know too much about his first wife, I do know that he was heavily using drugs, which was kind of motivation for his stealing and things like that.
Okay.
And he was very abusive.
Oh.
So it wasn't long before she left him. He married again in 1966, but he never divorced that first wife.
What?
He just changed his name on his birth certificate. And
because it's just easier to do that.
I don't know. Again, he's not interested in doing things properly. He's just like moving on to the next thing. He's not those. It's those societal norms that he cannot
abide by
or even observe.
Yeah.
So the second marriage was already off to a rough start, you know, being that he's already married and But then he was arrested for stealing a credit card from a convenience store where he worked.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. He was, like I said, very addicted to drugs. And since he didn't want to work for money so that he could fund his drug habit, he continued to steal. That's just what he did. This time, his sentence was a bit harsher, and he spent 3 years in the state prison. I'm not sure what prompted his next move or this change of heart, but when he was released, he decided to do things the right way. He ended up divorcing his first wife and legally marrying his second wife.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
And she was still going along with him.
It's romantic, right? I mean, she stuck with him through his jail term. And I mean, it probably seemed romantic to her that he was properly marrying her because he was such a disappointment in all other areas. Mm-hmm. But sadly, they didn't make it another year before going their separate ways.
No.
He wasted no time marrying again.
Right.
Wife number three was Edith Ballew, who would stick around for about 8 months.
Gosh.
The difference between this split and the previous two was that Edith, she was different. She was a different lady.
Okay.
She stayed in touch with his family and kind of kept up with his ongoings in the way that a curious ex would keep up with their ex.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like, she was friends with his mother, so.
Yeah.
Of course, there wasn't social media back then, so she would go visit his mom, get some information, and this will come into play later.
Okay.
But much like every other non-married interval, this one was short as well. And if you know your serial killer criteria, psychopath checklist, this is one, multiple marriages. So wife number four was a lady named Joyce Adeline Catlin. Of course, all these poor women took his last name. Joyce worked in the local welfare department and had 8 children.
Whoa.
None of whom were fathered by Stephen. Thank the good Lord for that. While married to Joyce, Stephen was working in an auto garage. And then he began working for a race car driver, Glendon Emery, as part of his pit crew. He loved cars, so this seemed like a great fit for him. And for the first time ever, these were like real jobs.
Yeah, he's trying
at life. I mean, sounds like it, right? Not sure how he got that job.
Yeah.
I guess they didn't do any kind of background check. Anywho, he took a liking to Glendon Emery's stepdaughter.
Oh, of course he did.
And started dating her on the side.
Oh, Lord.
While married to this fourth wife. In April of 1976, Joyce got really sick. She had severe flu-like symptoms and was complaining of back pain. She was vomiting, had a sore throat. So she went to the doctor to get some help, and they sent her directly to the hospital.
Mm.
Whoever saw her was like, honey, you need to be on an IV. I mean, you are dehydrated.
Oh, yeah.
And so they got her stabilized initially and she got better. I mean, with, you know, the medicines and stuff they were giving her. But just days later, she took a turn for the worse and was transferred to the intensive care unit. Now, they sent a lung specialist by the name of Dr. Einstein.
Aw.
Yeah. to assess her. And if anyone could help her, it was this guy, they thought.
Okay.
He believed that perhaps, because it, the reason was because they couldn't really figure out what was going on with her. They were like, okay, we can tell she can't really breathe very well. And all the antibiotics they were giving her weren't working. And so.
And it wasn't, it was not the flu.
Well, yeah. And he had suspected that it was viral or bacterial.
Okay.
But those antibiotics weren't working. So, you know, he was like, oh, I don't know. You know,
right.
I don't know what this is. But they found that she had fluid built up on her lungs. She had a myriad of other symptoms that she was presenting, and he really tried. But on May 6th, 3 weeks after being admitted to the hospital, Joy died after her lungs just completely gave out.
Aww.
Of course, in these circumstances, the hospital will order an autopsy. And I recently learned that it's often not really up to the family at this point.
Oh, okay.
The hospital can order one. So the pathologist, Dr. Bruce Swinier, noted that she had gross pulmonary fibrosis, which is a condition where the lungs develop massive scarring and they're unable to perform the exchange of oxygen.
Oh, okay.
And carbon dioxide properly. And after Dr. Swinier examined her extremely heavy lungs, he found no indication of viral or bacterial infection in there, as they previously thought, that would have been responsible for her death. He listed her cause of death as acute respiratory failure due to unknown microorganisms.
Okay.
And after that, Stephen had her body cremated.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. 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 A year later, Stephen married his fifth wife, Glenna K. Catlin, in May of 1977. They moved to Fresno, where he took a job at another auto garage.
Hmm.
They were actually really impressed with him.
Oh, okay.
They were not wearing their glasses or anything else to aid them in all of their senses that day.
he was putting on the charm.
I guess. But they were impressed that he used to work in a pit crew for that race car driver. So, I mean, they really were like, whoa, you. And he actually pretty soon became a supervisor, and he was responsible for managing like 40 employees there.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. I mean, serious stuff. Like, I mean, it wasn't just one of these things, but this is looking good for him, right?
Yeah.
Like, but as you know, things would not be picture perfect for him for very long, because his dad died suddenly, October 28th of 1980.
Aww.
Now, his autopsy revealed that his lungs were filled with fluid. So his death was attributed to his lung cancer.
Okay.
So he had lung cancer at the time of his death, but reports indicated that he died suddenly because he wasn't sick when he died. He wasn't in poor health like people with cancer deteriorate. He just died and, you know, he seemed to be coping with the illness well at the time. Stephen ordered his father's body to be cremated, and he did inherit a bit of money, though I wasn't able to find out how much it was. It may have been a little, it may have been a lot, but whatever it was, Stephen blew through it pretty quickly.
Guy.
And he was back to square one, you know, being a broke loser.
Yeah.
It is said that Stephen had expensive taste, which makes me laugh because, like, where do you get off?
Yeah.
He's the type of guy where if he had just $100 to his name, he would go out for a steak dinner.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and put on a show, and instead of, like, using that for bills or whatever he needed to use. So he still had this job at this auto garage. He was managing employees. Everything was going fine. He wasn't satisfied, obviously, with how much he was making. Mm-hmm. It was probably more than he ever made in his life. But, of course, can't be tamed. It was going okay until some of his employees noticed that some auto parts were going missing.
Oh.
At first, they probably just thought things were being misplaced. I mean, auto garages are not the most organized organized places.
Well, and if you have a lot of employees there, yeah. I mean, anything can be moved around.
Well, sure. And I hope that doesn't offend anyone, but like if you're working on a car and you just set a wrench down and, you know, like it gets kicked or, you know what I mean? Like at first they probably thought nothing of it until it became like this pattern. And it definitely was ongoing, they could see. And they weren't stupid. You know what I mean? They're like, okay, now I definitely know I put that there and it's gone.
And it's not like there's cameras to watch. Oh, back in that day,
of course. Shortly after the theft began, management conducted a routine background check on several employees. They were like, all right, this sums up. And they discovered Steven's unsavory past.
Oh, my goodness.
Not sure why they didn't do this background check when he was employed, but they didn't. So they ended up letting him go. Actually, reports say they forced him to resign, which, same thing. Mm-hmm. And they didn't press charges. So
they're like, let's just wash our hands of this guy.
They were like, yeah. So he was on his way. He was probably feeling pretty proud of himself for skirting the law. However, without a job, Stephen was feeling this financial pressure again. He had blown through all of his inheritance that he got from his dad. You know, whatever he stole from this place, it was gone and of no use to him. And this would push him to the point of desperation. So February 17th, 1984, Kay, his wife, traveled with her mother to Vegas on a little mother-daughter trip. They were really excited. I mean, they'd been planning this for a while. But shortly after they arrived in Vegas, Kay started feeling really ill. I mean, so ill, in fact, that they returned to Fresno.
No.
I mean, it was so bad. She wasn't like, oh, I'll just take a nap and feel better. It was like so violent. She had to go home.
Oh, my gosh.
So they returned the same day. and that should tell you how sick she was right there. She went straight to the hospital when she got back to Fresno, and they admitted her. Admitted her. Mm-hmm. That's how bad she was. Doctors found that she had fluid on her lungs, but they couldn't really make sense of what was really wrong with her. And as they're still running tests and trying to figure out what exactly could be wrong, she died March 14th.
Oh. Yeah. Same story, different wife.
Exactly. And in true Stephen fashion, he ordered her cremated.
Gosh.
Now, Kay's remains weren't even scattered to the winds yet before Stephen was already engaged to someone else, a lady named Carol Johnson. And from reports, apparently, he met this woman while visiting poor sick Kay at the hospital.
That's just gross.
If you can believe it.
Run.
Gross indeed. Shortly after Kay's death, he cashed out her $58,785 life insurance policy, which gave him the capital to start a new life.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money, especially back then. Remember Edith Ballew, Stephen's third wife, who narrowly escaped death as far as I'm concerned? Well, she heard about Kay's death, and she was like, didn't another one of his wives die?
Yes.
Of a mysterious illness?
Yes, she did.
Years ago. And it nagged at her. She didn't know what to make of it at the time, but she was very suspicious that the two women's deaths were not a coincidence. And she had good reason to be suspicious because she remembered that 2 years before, Stephen's mom, Martha, had a stroke. And Edith was like, how did that happen? Like, it just, she was fine and then she wasn't. And she was like, I think Stephen poisoned her or something. Oh, like, that's just, she just had this feeling. So she actually was so convicted about that she called Martha's doctor.
Oh.
Yeah, Martha Stevens' mother, and told him at the time. She's like, I think Martha was poisoned. Can you just check that out? And the doctor was like, I mean, there's no evidence that she was poisoned.
Just go with it. Come on.
Yeah. And she just didn't press the matter because she probably felt stupid. You know, she probably felt like she was sticking her nose in where it didn't belong. Now, all the hairs on her body are probably standing at attention, and she's doing everything in her power to fight this urge to report her suspicions again.
Okay.
Right? Because look what happened last time. Nothing. So she doesn't want to be in that position again. So she paid Martha a visit. She was like, I'm just going to go check on her. You know, this is weird.
Yeah.
So she went to visit Martha on November 29th, 1984, just to catch up and probably see if she could get some more information, you know, like piece together timelines of these two women's deaths, and maybe something might slip out. Because Martha and Stephen at this point didn't have the best relationship. Martha really disapproved of all his marriages, all his thievery, you know,
his antics.
Yeah. She just was like, you're a huge disappointment.
Yeah.
That's too bad, you know? So I'm sure Martha let things slip or talked to Edith freely about him in certain ways. So another thing was, like, Edith wanted to make sure she was in good health, like to put her mind at ease, and she was healthy, alert. You know, they had a good visit. It was fine. Everything was fine. But just over a week later, on December 8th, 1984, Martha, at 79 years of age, suddenly died.
A week later. Like, she was
a week later.
Edith was on to something.
Yep. So Martha died from what first responders believed at first to be just another stroke. She had been taken by ambulance to the hospital and was pronounced dead on arrival. Stephen called up the crematorium because at this point he's got them on speed dial. But the hospital's like, hold on. We think she died of a stroke, but we need to confirm that with an autopsy.
Yes, please.
So chill. And it was so good that she was taken to the hospital because they were able to do that. I think that had she been pronounced dead at her home, maybe.
Okay.
This wouldn't have taken place. An autopsy would not have been performed. The pathologist who performed her autopsy gathered tissue samples for analysis. Meanwhile, you've got Edith over here going, excuse me?
Yeah.
I was just with her. I was literally with her last week and she was fine.
Ugh.
And she's like, that's it. I'm calling the authorities. Like, yes. I'm not beating around the bush any longer.
Good on
so
you,
she
Edith.
She went straight to the sheriff and told him, you know, I was married to Stephen. Here's what's been going on the past several years. She outlined how two of his wives died of a mysterious illness that nobody could figure out what it was. And now his mother's died a week after she's seen her in perfectly good health.
Wow.
And she's like, look, I think he's responsible for their deaths. I think he's poisoning all of them. And I'm begging you to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So the police followed up with Mercy Hospital, where Joyce died. Joyce, remember, is his fourth wife, who died back in 76.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, what evidence could they possibly have? She was cremated.
Right.
Right? Well, someone at the hospital who deserves a pay raise, as far as I'm concerned, saved some tissue samples before she was cremated.
Good job.
And they still had them.
I am so impressed.
Yes.
Wow.
You see, doctors were really suspicious when Joyce died. However, it was 1976 and certain toxicological, you know, tests were not available, but they were very curious because they were like, this doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem natural. So they were like, we're going to hang on to these tissue samples and hopefully technology will, you know, in the near future come about and we can analyze these.
Wow. And that was years that it went by.
Yes. Yes. But in 1976, they didn't just retain those tissue samples. Dr. Einstein, remember him, living up to his name, he sent a sample to a professor friend of his who was an expert in lung pathology. shortly after Joyce died. He's like, I want you to take a look at this and tell me what you think. This all happened right after Joyce died, by the way.
Okay.
Okay. This Dr. Kilburn examined the samples taken from Joyce's lungs and noted that the amount of fibrosis that nearly destroyed her lungs was not caused by anything naturally occurring. Mm. So they knew that it was a chemical. He's like, I know it's a chemical. Like, I've seen this, you know. Well, there just so happened, it's like God had arranged all this. There just so happened to be a visiting professor that was an expert in paraquat poisoning. He was visiting the wow. the university, and Dr. Kilburn said, hey, can you come look at this real quick? I just got these from a colleague of mine. So he took a look at the slides, and he said it looked perfectly like paraquat poisoning. He's like, that's exactly what it looks like. Now, you're probably thinking, why didn't they go to the police?
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
Back in 76? Well, Dr. Einstein said he did bring it to the attention of the district attorney back in 76, but nothing happened.
Girl.
Then, so it turns out that around that time, Edith also raised suspicions after Joyce died. And an investigator, Skinner, was assigned to follow up on the allegations, and he did nothing of the sort.
Oh. Ugh.
So it just seems like the police wanted proof from the doctors, but they didn't really ask for proof from the doctors. And it just kind of was like, okay, yeah, we'll follow up on that. And it wasn't done.
Yeah.
Ugh, as frustrating as all of that is, finally, the police are involved now.
Yeah, one more person had to die for it too.
Uh-huh. Two more people.
Well, true. Okay, yes.
So the police are involved now, and the remaining lung tissue samples were sent off for forensic analysis. Now, it's now November 1984.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just Joyce's tissue samples that were sent off, though. Martha's were also. Things were coming together here.
Yeah.
Each of the labs found that both Joyce and Martha's toxicology showed paraquat poisoning.
Interesting.
Now, paraquat is not an exotic fruit, like it might sound. It is a weed killer. It's actually so lethal that it's been banned in 24 countries, starting with Switzerland back in 1989.
Oh.
Yeah, Switzerland knows what's up. Now, there have been publications linking its use to Parkinson's disease and other serious health concerns.
Holy moly.
But unsurprisingly, we still use it in the U.S. However, not just anyone can buy it now. They've put big restrictions on it, and you have to be like a commercial agriculturist or have a license in, you know.
So it's not just like at Lowe's?
It's not at Lowe's. No, you cannot buy it from Lowe's. It has to be like purchased. You have to have a license for commercial use.
Okay.
Now, they actually have something to call these suspicious deaths, and they're poisonings, right?
Yeah.
And now they need to connect the dots. They had a suspect in mind, none other than Stephen Catlin, and it wasn't just his proximity to the victims that was of interest.
Right.
He was gaining financially from their deaths.
Uh-huh.
So a search warrant was executed on Stephen's home. And guess what they found in the garage?
Paraquat.
A bottle of paraquat. I mean, it was as bright and shiny as a hiney during a diaper change. It was there in full force, okay? And it turned out that it had his fingerprints all over it. So just another tidbit there. There was no question about what he'd been up to for the past several years. Investigators now want to speak with Kay's doctor,
mm-hmm.
the one who's, you know, got sick and returned home from Vegas.
Yes, please do.
And luckily, they had taken tissue samples from Kay's body at autopsy.
Way to go, guys.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is one of those stories where it's like everybody was, well, let's not talk about 76 after Joyce died, but like,
now
some
now
people in the hospital were doing their due diligence, at least. But those were also sent off
okay.
and determined to have paraquat poisoning.
Shocker.
No surprise there. While all this is going on, all these puzzle pieces are being put together, Stephen married again.
No.
This is marriage number 6, if you're losing count. But they wouldn't make it to the honeymoon phase. No. Because he was indicted on 3 counts of murder on December 23rd, 1985.
Okay.
For the deaths of Joyce, Kay, and Martha Catlin. Let's talk about trial.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he was tried for the murders in the way that he was. Maybe because it was the most recent and they had more overwhelming evidence. But he went on trial for Kay's murder first.
Oh.
And that trial began in May of 1986. Now, experts testified about the possession of paraquat in his garage, the multiple affairs Stephen had while married to Kay, and his lust for money. And I'm going to get into the nitty-gritty in the other trial because they were very similar, evidence-wise. For Kay's murder, he was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. Now, he was tried for Joyce and Martha, wife number 4, and his mother together.
Okay.
He was tried for both of these murders at the same trial. So at that trial, the pathologist who performed the autopsy, Dr. Swinier, testified about the state of Joyce's lungs at the time of her death. Dr. Einstein, his buddy, and his buddy, you know, Dr. Kilburn, the one who he sent the samples to back in 76, they both testified to their examination of the tissue samples and their suspicions of paraquat poisoning back then.
Hmm.
Now, there was also a clinical toxicologist with the Chevron Environmental Health Center that described to the jury just what exactly paraquat poisoning was. And I'm going to read you an excerpt from the legal document from the Supreme Court of California. So it said, quote, initially, the patient experiences a burning sensation in the mouth, and then after about 12 hours develops symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. These symptoms may persist for a few days, but by the 7th day after ingestion, the patient may feel somewhat better. Some kidney impairment may follow, but normally is resolved after about 14 days. The lungs become affected about a week after ingestion, and by the 3rd week, they typically are so fibrotic that they cannot function. He noted that consistently with these typical stages, Joyce experienced vomiting and other gastrological symptoms for about 7 days and then developed some kidney dysfunction. As that resolved, she complained about shortness of breath, and x-rays disclosed some markings of the lungs and edema.
Hmm.
End quote. So her lungs then continued to deteriorate. And that's what happens with paraquat poisoning. They suffer so badly because they have so many different symptoms and they seem to all get better, but the lungs are what gives out in the end.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's really sad. The prosecution didn't present much direct evidence about how the poison might have been administered.
Mm-hmm.
But there was testimony about a party that he had attended with Joyce right before her symptoms began, where she had clearly been drinking. And I think there was insinuation about he may have dosed her drink at that time. Probably the most damning evidence, though, for possible mode, was that Stephen brought her a milkshake to the hospital.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm going to make sure you ain't going to live.
Right. And she took a turn for the worse not too long after that.
Wow.
Additionally, like in the previous trial, evidence was presented that showed that Stephen had access to paraquat. And here we learn where he got it. So he was working for an agricultural company back in 76.
Oh.
Remember that restricted use whole thing?
Yeah.
Well, he was able to get his grubby little hands on it when he was employed there. He even talked about it with other employees or people he knew that he had it in his garage. He even cautioned Joyce's son and said, don't go in the garage because there's really poison in there and it'll kill you. And,
oh,
you know, just stuff like that. He just kind of flaunted it. Now, as it relates to Martha, Stephen's mother, there's so many people. I've got to remind you who Martha is, right? Yeah. Trial testimony outlined the 2 days before Martha's death. So on December 6th, remember she dies on the 8th, December 6th, 1984, Martha called her friend Anna to take her to the doctor because she was seriously ill. Hmm. So Anna said that Martha had purple lips and dark circles under her eyes.
She wasn't getting her oxygen.
Yeah. So she took her straight to Dr. Sproul, who was her primary care doctor. He said, well, here's some penicillin.
No.
Come back tomorrow. I'm not kidding. Lena's left dead. The room. She's gone. So Anna called Stephen and said, you really need to come down here. Like your mom's not doing well. She's very sick. Now, Stephen lived in Fresno, remember, at the time. His mother lived in Bakersfield, and this is about an hour and a half away.
Okay.
And he was like, oh, well, I can't come. I just can't come. I don't know what he was up to or what he was doing, but he made some excuse that he couldn't come and take care of her. And actually, Anna couldn't stay with her that night for whatever reason. So the next day, Anna came back and took Martha back to the doctor because she was not doing good. She could see that she was getting worse. Mm-hmm. And she's like, what? This penicillin is not helping. So he sent her home again. The doctor. The doctor sent her home again and was like, you know, sleep it off. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what he said, but oh my God, this doctor. Like,
I have no words.
I guess Anna stayed that night with her because she found Martha dead at 5:30 a.m. on December 8th. And now I say she found her dead. She called emergency line saying that Martha appeared to be dead. And so they sent an ambulance. And it's thank God they did all that because they had that evidence.
Right.
Eventually. So that was December 8th when she died. Now, the pathologist who conducted Martha's autopsy, Dr. Dollinger, concluded that she was poisoned after receiving the toxicology reports. Many of the same doctors that testified about Joyce's demise also spoke to Martha's death. And why not? They were the same, right?
Yeah.
The state alleged the victims were not only killed in the same way, they were killed for the same reason, which was the financial gain.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen didn't exactly clean up when Joyce died, but her life insurance policy did pay off one of their cars, which I think was like $6,000, almost $7,000, and he got an additional $7,000 payout. I mean, he doesn't care that it's not a lot. He's just scraping by through life.
Right.
That's the thing. Is some people would be like, oh, you wouldn't kill someone for $7,000. No, you wouldn't kill somebody for $7,000, but someone with that pathology, they don't care. They're like, oh, it's $7,000. I'm going to just, and then I'll commit my next crime, you know? Yeah. He was the sole beneficiary of his mother's estate. And though I couldn't find what that was worth to him, he and his mother actually had apparently withdrawn a large sum of money from her bank account a month before she died. That was supposed to be a down payment on a house for her in Fresno. You see, he had been like, why don't you come move up here so that, you know, I can take care of you and it's not so far. And he kept that money.
Of course.
He never put any down payment on a house for her.
He didn't plan on it.
Now, fun fact here, just a little insert. There was a psychologist by the name of David Kirshner. He did a case study on Stephen in his 2006 book, Adoption, Uncharted Waters, and suggested that Stephen poisoned his adoptive mother, Martha, because his biological mother took her own life via poisoning.
And he knew this?
That was in his book. So I didn't see anywhere else that it was reported. I assume this doctor had access to maybe his...
But, like, did Stephen know that about his biological mother?
I think that's what he's saying here, that because he knew his mother, his biological mother, took her own life with poisoning.
Right.
He wanted to repeat the same action. I'm not a psychologist, but I can't fully agree with it.
I don't agree.
He may have gotten the idea from her to, you right. know, that, but Martha was not his only victim. So,
yeah,
this guy seems a little bit like Freud to me, mommy issues type of thing. But anyway, I thought that was interesting because it was just another piece to his past, that his mother had taken her life with poisoning. Anywho, the jury was actually not informed of the murder conviction for Kay in this trial when they went off to deliberate. But they did learn about it at the sentencing phase.
Oh.
So on June 5th, the jury found him guilty of both murders. And the next day, they recommended life without the possibility of parole for Joyce's murder and death for Martha's murder. Mm. And the court imposed both sentences. Now, Stephen's attorneys motioned for a new trial about a month later, which was denied. Mm-hmm. And he actually didn't appeal the verdict until many years later in 1998. He'd gone through like a couple of attorneys at that point, and I guess that maybe drew things out a bit. But the verdict was upheld. In August of 2000, he filed a writ of habeas corpus, which, if you don't know, basically protects you from wrongful imprisonment, which it doesn't seem like an appropriate thing, like petition to file, because he killed three people. So you're definitely not falsely imprisoned. But I think he was just grasping at straws.
I was just about to say that.
He was grasping at straws because before that, he filed a writ of certiorari, which basically is asking for the higher court to take another look at the trial. I mean, the case.
Oh, okay.
So that was denied. And he's like, okay, I'll try the habeas corpus writ. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he was doing these himself or what. But his last appeal claimed that Joyce and Martha's murders shouldn't have been tried together, and that one victim prejudiced the sentence of the other. Basically, he's saying, because I killed my wife, you are now sentencing me to death for my mother's murder, because there were two murders. Mm. So he thought that was prejudice.
But you did it, so
all right.
Go fly a kite.
But the Supreme Court upheld the death sentence that was handed down by Superior Court Judge Louis E. King in 1990, saying that the cases were so similar. I mean, the motive, means, opportunity, they were all nearly identical, and they tried the case appropriately, which I agree. So Stephen is currently on death row at San Quentin State Prison. If you want to go visit him or write him a little letter,
tell him
how much he sucks. there's one more person I want to talk about before we go, and that's Stephen's dad.
Right.
Remember, he died suddenly in 1980?
Mm-hmm.
Now, his dad did have lung cancer. Yes. But his lungs were filled with fluid, which is a symptom that all three poisoning deaths that he was convicted for had. He's never been tried or charged in the death of his father, and likely never will be.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll likely never know the truth about that. But everyone remains a bit side-eye about that, because seems like the perfect murder to me.
Yeah, considering the lung cancer. I mean, and he got inheritance money from, I mean, so it's the exact same thing.
Yeah, so in my opinion, it was like the perfect murder.
Yeah.
Because by all accounts, his dad was not sick. Mm-hmm. His dad was not on his deathbed.
Mm.
As cancer usually works through someone's body, they generally deteriorate. And he was not, that just wasn't the case.
Right.
All reports say he died suddenly. So I particularly think that it was the perfect murder. So.
Yeah, and I'm assuming doctors didn't save any of his tissue to test.
I didn't see anything about an autopsy for him.
Yeah.
I think it just seemed like he died of cancer and that was it.
Goodness.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say before we close, like they say in church, let's bow our heads. The last thing I'll say is, oh, you know what? I didn't look up the name of this movie. Hang on a second. This case was featured in a TV movie starring Harry Hamlin, a.k.a. Mr. Lisa Rinna, if you watch The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, which I do. But it's called Poisoned by Love, The Kern County Murders.
Oh.
If you would like to watch it for some dramatic effect.
Right.
But know that it's probably not
exactly
accurate, but it might be fun for you to watch. After hearing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was a mess. I feel dirty now. I feel dirty. Yeah. I need a shower. I'm going to go drink some water without poison in it and thank my lucky stars.
Goodness. There was so much to that. It's just like one right after the other. And the fact that he just thought he was going to get away with it or just didn't even care.
Didn't care. That's the thing. He didn't care about nothing.
I mean, for his whole
true
life.
True psychopath.
Yeah.
For sure.
That's one thing I've always thought about. Like if I ever adopted a child, what they would turn out like.
Yeah. It's
because you can give them so much love and teach them a certain way. And
well, you could do that with your own children. It's like a gene. I always call it a dance. Genes and environments. It's like our biology is influenced by our environment. Our environment is influenced by us, which you could argue is our biology. And I mean, there's so much research out there, but you can never predict almost an outcome. You can have a loving home. But if someone's a psychopath, they're going to be what they're going to be.
Yeah.
There's like no helping that. They're going to turn out the way they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I could talk for another hour about this subject, but
We won't bore you.
I'm going to start a whole nother podcast so I can just talk about that. Let me just say one more thing about even siblings who are raised in the same environment.
Yeah.
Turn out differently.
Oh,
very
yeah.
Very differently.
You can raise them the exact same.
Same biology, same environment, two totally different outcomes.
Oh, yeah.
Look around you, folks.
We've seen it time and time again.
You know, people talk about there's always the one in the family. There's always the one in the family. Okay. Yeah. There's just some hard wiring going on in some people that just will not be undone or helped. So. I really will stop talking about that, but I could literally go on for another hour about that. But anyways, that's all I have for you about this case.
Well, thank you for telling us of the story. Oh. Fly high, angels. Sorry you came in contact with this lunatic.
Isn't that Joyce had 8 children.
Oh my gosh.
8 people lost their mother.
Wow.
Because someone was like,
I want her money.
So, anyway, very, very sad case.
That's it. We're done. We're talking. Well, that was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it. We'll see you next week, guys.
Bye.
Bye now. Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider leaving us a positive review and rating. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to our show.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or send case suggestions to cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.